Hey, gang. Are you in a band? You live in Austin? You're trying to make the leap from Band of Schmoes to full-on bros? Well, you can start by rehearsing at Space. Space is a state-of-the-art, affordable venue for rehearsal and recording located just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. It's a great location. 31 spacious rooms, large corridors, an elevator. Call them at 512-448-9518. Find out what's going on or go to spaceatx.com. Space, rehearsal and recording. Let's get
down.
Yeah, that's right.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I've got a great show for you today. I have a fantastic conversation with Clint Wells, musician from Nashville, who was in town getting ready to go on tour playing guitar with Bob Schneider. He's a fantastic songwriter. He's a great guitar player. He's just a great all-around musician. He's a beautiful singer. He's incredibly prolific. He's got a great SoundCloud page, which you can get to by going to clintwellsmusic.com. Anyway, he plays with Bob Schneider, Mindy Smith, Dugas, yeah, it's called, Laura Bell Bundy, Matthew Mayfield, just tons of people, Jesse Balin, tons and tons of people. But he lives out there in Nashville, and he flew in, came over to the house, and then I gave him a ride to his gig. Then I went to his gig later that night, and I really, really loved it. It was fantastic. I had a great time talking to Clint. I met him actually a couple years ago at a weird show that he played with Bob, and I talked to him that night. I actually remind him of that when the conversation starts. Anyway, great time. Clint Wells, he was here a few weeks ago. Get into it. Go to clintwellsmusic.com and check out his SoundCloud page. I listened to it again today when I was running, and it was fantastic. Speaking of running, it was cold this morning, and it's gotten colder throughout the day here in Austin. And now it's really cold, so I decided to make chili. I got some chili cooking, so the whole house smells like chili now. It's great. I love a chili smell. If you were listening to the last show, that was a few weeks ago, with the giant dog, I was making soup. It got cold, and so I made soup. Usually when it gets cold, whip out the crock pot, make a giant thing, a vat of something that is just kept warm that you can just eat in a soupy, chili, stewy way. Okay? All right, what else is going on with me? Skyrocket, we played in Austin and in Houston this weekend. Great shows. Bummer was Benjamin, our singer, was in a motorcycle accident and fortunately was not hurt in a bad way, but he did scrape himself up and took the weekend off because he was sore, very sore. And so we kind of improvised, the six of us, and we had guest drummers. Here in town, we had John Nelson. In Houston, we had John Gremion. And those guys were great, and it was really fun. It was really fun, you know, playing with guys you don't normally play with. It was fun trying to put something together because, you know, what we do is very regimented. You know, we play these shows. We go by this set list. We know these songs. We know our parts. We know who moves where. You know, different people sing different songs, so different people switch instruments. So there's a lot of moving around and stuff. So when one guy is taken out of the equation, there's a lot of songs you realize that, well, while he doesn't really sing that song, he plays the main piano part, or he, you know, plays the drums. And so on the ones that he played drums on that Darren sings, we had different drummers come up and play on a couple of songs, and that was really fun. John Nelson's a great guy. I love hanging out with him. I ended up going to see him play Sunday night when I got back from Houston. With the John Bush Experience. That was a great band. I didn't even get to talk to John, but man, saw all the guys. Everyone sounds great. John Bush has like a horn section. He's got Matt Hubbard playing keyboards. He's got Penny Joe Polis singing. He's just got the whole fucking thing down, and it's great. I love him. I love his presentation. Then I saw the Greasy Wheels, amazing band. You know, Cleve was on a couple weeks ago. Great conversation with him. You should go back and listen to it if you didn't hear it. Very interesting dude, man. From a great scene in Texas all the way to being Kinky Friedman's, running Kinky Friedman's campaigns. Crazy times. All right. So this weekend, Mr. Rocket Baby, December 6th. I'm telling you now, I think there's just a few tickets left at 1 to 1 Bar. Saturday, December 6th, if you remember the band I was in 1993 and 1994, Mr. Rocket Baby, the original dudes are getting back together after over 20 years to play. And if you're listening to, if you're listening to this to the day that it comes out, which is Tuesday, December 2nd, 2014, I will be on the radio with Richard tonight talking about that. Like I think at like 10:15 to 10:45. I don't know. 10:45 to 11:15. I think that's what it is. It's Laura Slow's show. Check it out. If you're not in Austin, you can hear it online. You can stream it at klbj.com. I think that's what it is. Just look up KLBJ 93.7 Austin and you'll get to that website. Just Google it. All right. I hope you're all doing well. If you're interested in coming to that Mr. Rocket Baby show, there's all kinds of invitations out there. You can just look it up on Facebook, Mr. Rocket Baby Reunion, and it'll pop right up, baby. And it has information on how to get tickets there at the One-to-One Bar, okay? And listen, seriously, my guest today, Clint Wells, is a fantastic dude. I loved sitting down and talking to him and getting to know him. He's a really nice guy. I had a great time seeing him play with Bob that night after we did this, and I hope that they had a great tour. I hope to see him next time he comes to town, or if I'm in Nashville, or if our paths cross out there in the nation of America on tour, which happens sometimes with those people that are out there playing. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. This man's a phenomenal talent and just a really great guy, a fantastic guy to talk to. Clint Wells, let's get down. Out in front, and you made me laugh a lot. I never forgot it.
What was going on that
you
night?
You played with Bob. You did that weird thing, just you and Bob.
The Hot Command.
Yeah, that was cool, man.
Wow. You know what's funny about that? Well, I was way gone. I was way out of my mind, because we did that right after a Saxon show.
Right.
And at that time, I was so unfamiliar. Well, not so unfamiliar, but the Saxon show was just a hard show for me, because we do like 20 songs that I just heard that day.
Yeah.
So I drink a lot at the Saxon to get through that show.
Yeah.
And then he'll, you know, sometimes he does these things where you have to like be a character. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he's had me rap a few times. So I'd get real loose for that show. And then I forgot that we were doing that Hot Command show. So, and that show was weird to begin with, because it was like all the electronic material.
Right.
And we were wearing masks. Do you remember that? We were like wearing wigs and masks.
Yeah. I remember the wig for sure.
And so I've talked to a few people who were at the show who were like, man, wow, that was something. And then I've talked to other people who were like, that was really cool.
I thought it was really cool.
Awesome.
I'm always like a fan of Bob's weirdest shit.
Yeah.
Like that record he made, I've seen The End of the World.
And this is what it looks like.
This is what it looks like. Yeah. Shit like that of his always trips me out. I love it.
It's fun. It's fun to like commit to it and commit to having a weird time, because something cool might happen, you know.
Yeah. How did you end up with that? How did you end up in that gig?
It's a little weird. I was touring with a guy named Griffin House, who's a Nashville singer-songwriter.
I didn't know if that was a band or a guy.
Yeah, people ask that all the time. We were out on the West Coast on our own tour, and I guess he knew Bob a little bit, and Bob was out there on his own tour. But we happened to converge and do a show together at the Carmel Film Festival. And we opened for Bob. And man, we were, everyone in Griffin's band, we were just young and excited and punks. And like, we all went on Bob's bus during their set and like stole all their booze. Like, we were just like, fuck these guys. We'll never see these guys again. Oh, and then like during Bob's set, we just all like ran out during Bombonanza, which we didn't even know that song, and we just started picking up percussion, and we were just like out of our minds.
That's weird, because there were times when I was telling you about that tour that I went on opening for him, he brought me up one night somewhere while I was walking by going to the bathroom, and he was like, Johnny, come here, dance, Johnny, dance. He commanded me to dance on stage.
Well, what's funny is, like, when I didn't know him, I was all about sabotaging the show. But now when he wants me to do something weird, I'm like, no.
You won't do it.
I'm like, please. Because we have a few characters that we do on stage that he thinks are really funny that I'm like, God damn it, I don't want to do this anymore. Or he used to tell people that, he used to introduce me as, he's like, this is Clint Wells, you may recognize him. He used to tour with Lady Gaga. but he got fired from the gig because he was a heroin addict. He used to like say that on stage. So after the show, I'd get people be like, "Wow, like, did you really have a problem with drugs?" I'm like, "No, you won't believe anything he says." You know,
that's awesome.
But anyway, we were playing in Carmel, and we had a really fun time. Like, we were just kind of fucking with them. But I also remember being like, man, this is really good. Like, because we saw some of the show, too. Well, the next day, we all happened to be in the same hotel, and I saw Bob in the lobby of the hotel. And I was just like, hey, man, we played last night. It was good to see you. Enjoyed your set. And he had watched our set, and I guess really liked it. And he said, you know, I saw your set. I don't ever watch the opening band, but it was really good. And he asked me about my guitar playing, and I was just like, well, he mentioned that he was kind of in between guitar players, and he asked where I lived and everything. I just kind of gave him my number. I was like, if you need a guitar player, call me, you know? And he was like, yeah, I think I'll do that. And then I didn't hear from him for like 8 months. I got a text from him out of the blue 8 months later. I didn't even know who it was. And the text was just like, hey, what are you doing in May? And he was inviting me on a tour. Like, it was a whole tour in May. It was a whole month.
Wow.
And so I was like, yeah, what are your thoughts about rehearsal? When should I come in? And he was like, we don't rehearse. You know, I'll send you a song list. He never sent a song list. So leading up to the gig, I just went and got all of his records off iTunes and learned all of his songs.
Jesus Christ. That is a feat.
Well, all the ones that are on records. It was no joke.
Yeah.
It was like 7 records worth of material because I wanted to take it really seriously. I just moved to Nashville. I didn't have a lot going on.
Where did you move there from?
From Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay.
And so I wanted to do a great job, and he never sent me a song list. So I remember the first night on the bus. I mean, it was the first night I met Bruce Hughes, the first night I met Conrad, first night I met all those guys, other than that one weird show 8 months before.
Right.
Where we stole all of their wine.
Right.
And I had printed out a list of all the songs, and I tried to like find a discreet moment while we were all hanging on the bus, and I said, "Hey Bob, can you just tell me what songs we're definitely not going to do on this list? These are all the songs I learned."
Right.
And he just looked at it, and he was like, "Everyone, look at this!" And he's like, "These are all the songs Clint learned for the tour," and he just showed everyone, and everyone just died laughing. You know,
because you're not playing any of those songs.
He was like, "Dude, yeah." Not only are we not playing these songs, we're going to play, like, we're going to draw from a pool of 30 more songs that you've probably never even heard.
Wow.
And he kind of just had that gleam in his eye of, like, can you do that? Is that something you can do? And I was just like, yeah, sure, you know. And so the whole first tour, we played at least 2 songs a night that I'd never heard. And I remember me and Conrad had a joke because Bob would start a song, and every song I would look at him, and I was like, is this 2002? The song 2002. I was like, is this one 2002? And that's what that whole first tour was like for me.
Wow.
You know, kind of learning the gig on stage in front of people.
Yeah. But was it hard? I mean, does he make it, like, in the moment when you're up there and you're learning the songs, like, how does he go, like, it's an E, or does he just start playing?
Oh, no. He just starts playing. But the only grace that he gives the band is that he starts the song. There's never a, like, right. 4 count, and then you're all in and you need to know it. So it's nothing crazy like that. But you have to listen, and you have to jump. It's sink or swim, you know?
You like that?
It's not my preferred way to make music in front of people. I like to be prepared.
Yeah.
I think I play better when I'm prepared. But there is something, an element to it that is spontaneous, where you do some pretty good, surprising work, if you'll go there.
Yeah.
If you clam up or get insecure about it, yeah, that'd probably be a disaster. But right. But I'd done all the homework. So when he'd bust out 40 Dogs or Honey Pot or something, right, that would kill. But if he wanted to take a left turn and do something he was excited about, I just went. I didn't care.
Yeah.
He's the boss, you know. And I was up for it.
Still are, obviously, or you wouldn't be
sure
here.
Yeah.
Who else are you playing with now? Like, what's your...
Well, it's different every year.
What's on the... Most recently?
I just did a gig with Mindy Smith, who is a hero of mine. She lives in Nashville, singer-songwriter. We did a tour last year, a UK tour. I was out for most of the year last year with a rock band called Dugas, D-U-G-A-S,
mm-hmm,
which is like a... It's like Radiohead, but with a soul singer. It's really cool. And we were on Zac Brown's record label, so we went out and did like three or four months opening up for Zac.
How was that?
Insane. Insanely awesome. Like, all the bucket list venues that you dream of playing. Hollywood Bowl and the Gorge.
No shit.
Red Rocks. Huge, huge shows.
I saw those pictures. They were really...
I mean, yeah, Zach sells 20 to 30,000 tickets a night. And we weren't selling the tickets, but we were able to... We were direct support, so we were able to go out there and play for an hour each night. And
no shit.
That's what most of my year was last year, was with Duga. It was pretty exciting.
What label are they on? They're on his label?
They were on his label, which was called Southern Ground Records, but that label has since dissolved. So now they're indie again.
Okay. You still doing stuff with them at all?
Or? Yeah, but because the label folded, they're kind of back in a DIY building phase. They're writing. It's a brother and sister. Okay. The brother plays drums, sister sings. So they would just have a guitar player and a bass player come out. But I was in the band for about 6 or 7 months. I'm still in the band where they're just not doing anything. If they call me tomorrow and we're like, hey, we're going to go out and do this tour, can you do it? I would probably commit to that.
Yeah.
That was the closest that I've actually been to being in a band in a long time.
Did you come up with your own stuff and everything? Is that, or was it?
I had a band in high school.
No. I mean, did you come up with your own parts and everything? Oh, is that what you mean?
No. For the Duga stuff? They had made the record with dudes in town, in Nashville. So I didn't really have to do that. We were working on some new stuff where I was going to be more creative, but for the most part, I was just a hired gun as far as parts go. But it was cool. It was a really fun band. It was right up my alley. It was like ambient rock, you know, Johnny Greenwood, Johnny Marr.
There seems to be a lot, like I listened to those songs on your SoundCloud. You have a good handle on that sort of, you can tell Lenoir's an influence on the ambience in the recordings.
Yeah.
The space.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I love plugging a guitar straight into an amp. I love that. But I also have no problem fucking it up with pedals or running a guitar through anything.
Yeah.
I think it's cool. It's interesting. You know?
Yeah. How did you get started? What was the thing that made you want to play guitar?
Well, my grandfather, who lives in Montgomery, Alabama, he's always collected old Gibsons and Martins. So by the time, you know, since I was a little boy, I grew up just with really badass vintage acoustic guitars always around me.
Yeah.
So that's always there. And then, you know, when I was 12 or 13, I went, my first concert was a Kiss concert.
Oh, yeah.
The Kiss Reunion Tour 96.
Oh, yeah.
With the original four members. Mm-hmm. There's your guy.
I'm going to close that window. Hang on.
Okay.
With such a esteemed guest such as yourself.
Oh, no, I'm furious.
Flying in all the way from Nashville just to do this interview. So your grandfather had all these guitars?
He had all those guitars. So I always liked the guitar. I liked the way it looked. And then, you know, when I was 12 or 13, I saw Kiss. And, I mean, I must be one in a million people who wanted to play music because of Kiss. And I'm still a huge Kiss fan, much to the ridicule of a lot of my peers in Nashville.
But I bet. Yeah, I get it here too, man. I mean, I'm a guy. I mean, I was there in the original times.
Okay, cool.
And, yeah.
Do you have a favorite Kiss record?
Yeah, man, I like Destroyer.
Yeah, Destroyer.
And I love Rock and Roll Over.
I love Rock and Roll Over.
Dressed to Kill.
Dressed to Kill.
Yeah.
But those first three records, The Kiss, Dressed to Kill, and Hotter Than Hell, and then of course Alive.
Yeah.
I mean,
I love those early ones. Like, a lot of people talk about how they sound like shit, but I like the way they sound. Like, I think they sound cool as shit.
I think they sound real, and they are cool. I can see the argument that they don't sound great.
Yeah.
I understand it, but I just don't care about that. I mean,
yeah,
Velvet Underground records don't sound good either. Hank Williams records don't
No, know? But in my list of the world's greatest producers, I do put Andy Warhol up there for that record.
Sure.
Because that record has more vibe than almost any record ever made.
Totally. Well, at some point you have to like be into the idea that more goes into making a record great than like the fidelity,
right,
or the engineering.
Yeah.
If the songs are magical and the dudes that are in the room together are magical, that's all I care about.
Yeah.
So
geez, you're young, man.
I'm 31.
Yeah. That Kiss, that was a great Kiss tour. That's the only time I ever saw. I never saw them in the 70s.
I saw them on that tour, and then I saw them on the Psycho Circus tour, which was 2000. Still with Ace and Peter. And then that was the last time I saw them. But I still keep up with them. I don't buy their new records, but I'm still a big fan, and I'm a big fan of like their presence.
Are you like an Ace guy? Is that what got you going on guitar? Were you like, shit, yeah, man?
Oh yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, big time. I mean, some of the first songs I learned were Strutter and Deuce.
Oh yeah.
And my dad gave me the Alive vinyl. I didn't have a record player, but I had the vinyl in my room.
Yeah.
And I used to just stare at that vinyl cover. I used to like count the frets because on that cover Ace is holding the guitar.
Yeah.
And I used to just count the frets on it. I mean, I was into it, man. I was like into the whole deal.
That's so weird because I used to, at the Kiss Alive 2 one, like when you open the inside and the explosions and they're on those
the risers.
Hydraulic lifts. Yeah. It's fucking.
Well, in Kiss Alive 2, I mean, has that big shock me moment.
Yeah.
Shock me from Love Gun.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a young guitar player watching this fucking alien, his guitar is smoking guitar and shooting rockets and then. You got the dude spitting blood, and I even loved Paul Stanley. Like, I loved their whole deal.
Yeah,
still do. But it is an uphill battle getting some of your buds on board.
Yeah,
with it,
you know, Bob used to be managed by
the dude who manages Kiss,
Doc McGee. Yeah,
Doc McGee.
And I ran into him at the Saxon on a Monday, and my old girlfriend Sandy used to work for Bob, and she was like, "You want to come up to the Saxon tonight?" And I was like, "I don't know." She's like, "Yeah, I got a big night. Doc McGee's going to be there," and I was like, I'm going to go because it was right when they replaced Ace and Peter.
Mm.
So I was wearing an Adam Temple button and he said something to me at the bar. So he was the guy that opened the conversation. So that was cool. So I told him I was a musician too and a huge Kiss fan and a huge fan of the work that he had done. But like, why did Gene and Paul think they could replace Ace and Peter and not think anyone like me wouldn't notice? And he
right.
said, I don't know. That's Gene and Paul's band. They do what they want.
Right.
That was his response. So.
It is kind of a brilliant. It is brilliant how they've set it up to where it's a brand that any dude can wear the makeup, and if they can pair it the parts, I mean, I've seen either Gene or Paul talk about how one day they'll retire too, but Kiss will still be a band.
Yeah, it was in there like when that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing came out, and they were saying like, how can you put other guys in the makeup? He's like, anybody can be in the makeup,
and like. Am I interested in seeing that? Probably not. But I think that's cool.
Somewhere there'll be a 13-year-old kid that sees that. You know what I mean?
Who cares? I mean, yeah. Anyone who's a purist about something, I'm immediately skeptical of. Because who cares? Like, who really cares? I will say I'm a big Gwar fan, and Dave Brocky, the lead singer of Gwar, just died.
Yeah.
And they've replaced him, and the show's going to keep going. I'm not interested in seeing that show, but I don't have a problem with it.
No.
I can't imagine
being... And the guy's got to make a... What the fuck are those other guys going to do? They've been Gwar for fucking 30-something years.
Yeah, I don't think they have many prospects.
They're going to go be accountants or something?
Well, and it's just, if they want to carry on the tunes, awesome.
Sure, yeah.
Great. You know? But yeah, so Kiss was like real heavy on the beginning, and so was Pink Floyd. My dad really got me into some pretty dope records when I was young.
Well, it's interesting because was it 96, you said?
96, I was 13.
There was a lot of different world of music going on outside of classic rock. Were you tuned into that at all? Were you into what was happening in the alternative rock world of the mid to late 90s?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've never really been a snob about any music. I mean, another record I loved a lot when I was 13 was that Bush record, 16 Stone.
Yeah. That was a great band. I saw them.
I still think that. I listened to that record at the gym the other day, and I had a blast listening to it.
That has Everything Zen on it?
Has Everything Zen, Come Down, Little Things.
Yeah.
And it has Glycerine on it, which I do have a funny story about that. Glycerine is actually the first song I learned how to play on guitar.
Oh, really?
And I called a girl that I had a crush on in school.
Yes.
I was in seventh grade.
Yes.
Looked her up in the phone book. This is like old school, real shit. Looked her up in the phone book. Her mom answered, "Hey, can I speak with," I think her name is Shayna. "Hey, is Shayna around?" I said, "Hey, Shayna, it's Clint from school." "Well, you didn't talk in school." "It's Clint from school. I want to play you something on my guitar." And she's like, "Okay." Put the phone down, played Glycerine. Didn't sing it. Played it. The whole song. Like, all 3.5 minutes of it. It's just a chugging a bar chord. Picked back up, like, got to the end of it. Picked up the phone, I was like, "Hey, you still there?" And she's like, "Yeah." I was like, "Well, you know.
That was for you.
What'd you think, you know?"
Shame.
Just the courage. Like, yeah, I miss that guy.
I miss that guy, too.
I miss whatever that guy was thinking would work, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, first guitar, first song I learned, Bush, Glycerine. So I was into Bush. I've been a lifelong Pearl Jam fan.
Oh, yeah?
And in 96, they were doing their best shit. Those middle records, to me, are still their best were, Vitalogy and No Code.
Right.
I don't know if you were a Pearl Jam guy.
I'm not.
Okay.
But I respect the shit out of them.
Other,
I really do.
Other stuff I really dug in the mid-90s was the middle weird U2 period.
Yeah, the one that people don't talk about.
Zeropa and Pop.
Pop, yeah. Those were great records.
They're still my favorite U2 records.
Really?
So I was into some... I was into whatever was going on, but... I just like good music. I just liked whatever was good.
That's good.
I wasn't buying Chumbawamba records, I'll say that, you know.
Yeah, that's good.
What else is big then? I wasn't buying Smash Mouth records.
No.
You remember that band?
Yeah, of course. I remember Smash Mouth because I was in L.A. mixing a record, and I was living by myself at the Oakwood, and I went to a Universal City Walk one day,
mm-hmm.
and Mystery Men, the movie...
The Ben Stiller?
Yeah, I was coming out. And I guess that, hey, now you're a rock star. That
right.
was the song for the movie. But there was a kiosk every, like, 10 yards that had that preview on loop. And I just remember, like, every time I'd go to the City Walk for, like, 3 weeks, I had to deal with that song.
It's a good deal for Smash Mouth.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're like, here's what we should do. We should just pound it down everyone's throats, and then they'll have to like it. They'll have to think it's good.
Well, it's probably like, yeah. You're a horror movie guy. Are you mm-hmm. into like metal stuff? Did you ever go down that route?
Huge.
You're a Metallica. I saw that thing in your...
Well, I do love Metallica with a very deep love.
And the Metallica that you love, is that the Injustice for All, Ride the Lightning era?
Well,
are you post Black Album cool with that stuff?
Oh, love Load and Reload,
okay.
Which are the records that everyone hates. But when you break down the 80s, it's the Cliff Burton versus the Jason Newsted.
Right, of course.
And I was a Jason Newsted guy.
Okay.
And to this day, he's my favorite member of Metallica, although he's not been in the band for like 13 years. But he was always my favorite.
Yeah.
Always my favorite was Jason.
The nicest guy in that band, really.
He was he was always the dude that seemed like, oh, I could be that guy.
Yeah.
He didn't seem like a god, you know, the way Lars and James did. But I love all of Metallica's records. I don't like Saint Anger, but I bought it. You know, I was into it. I was there the day, you know, when as soon as the record store opened, I bought that record. Couldn't wait to put it in my car.
Can you play
the music?
Yeah, can you play really, really fast?
Oh,
I have
not.
Yeah.
Well, I was in a Metallica tribute band when I was in high school.
Oh.
But I didn't sing, but I was James Hetfield. So I did all that fucked up rhythm.
Okay.
Because one of my best friends who played was like a virtuoso. He could do all the metal stuff. I can't do that. So I was the rhythm guy. And we did all of it. I mean, at our high school, we did this high school show at the end of each year called Pelopalooza. Because I went to a high school called Pelham High School. And our Pelopalooza band was called Soma, based off a deep cut Smashing Pumpkins song.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And at Pelopalooza, we played the song One, and we played Fade to Black. Like, all 8 minutes of both of them, with strobe lights. I mean, we were into it.
That's awesome.
We were huge Metallica fans. But my favorite metal band's probably Pantera. I'm a big Pantera fan.
Oh, yeah.
I used to go to sleep listening to Cowboys from Hell.
I
would go to sleep with it.
That's awesome.
And I still buy it on vinyl, and my poor wife, she just doesn't. She doesn't get it.
She's not there. What does she listen to?
She listens to good stuff. She's a big Ginny Lewis fan. She likes Arcade Fire. Her favorite band is Kings of Leon.
Oh.
I'm not quite.
What
as
happened
big a
to
fan.
Those guys? I'm assuming like that since you live in Nashville, you must hang out with them.
Well,
you
actually,
have the longer hair.
I play with Jesse Balin, who's the drummer's wife.
Oh yeah, Jesse Balin. I saw that. She's great.
She's one of my favorite artists of all time, and I toured with her for a while in 2012. We did a lot of touring together. We did a big tour with The Fray, and she did some great headlining tours. She made a record called Little Spark that in 2012 that's incredible. It's probably the best record that I heard that year.
Really? What a great thing to get to be a part of that band then.
Awesome. The band was dope. It was awesome. But they had a baby, so she's kind of been in mom world. She just made a new record, though. But so anyway, just from playing with Jesse, like, I mean, Kings of Leon put out a new record, I guess, about a year ago that's really good.
Yeah.
And we get it all on vinyl because my wife's a big fan, and I like it. It's cool. I mean, I've got a lot of respect for them. I like them a lot. I've just never been that interested in buying their records, and of course now I don't have to be because my wife gets them all.
So they're there.
But they're still playing, touring, selling out. They're like a worldwide. They go to like Brazil and shit, and sell out. I mean,
what about Maiden? Do you ever get into Maiden?
Love Iron Maiden.
Yeah. Speaking love of them. Brazil. I love those guys.
Yeah, I mean, any band that can sell 90 million records without radio play. I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of people, and I think there's like a connection between metal music and horror films.
That's what I was getting to. There's an overlap. You said you liked horror films, and I was like, that's usually like a... they go hand in hand.
Well,
I think kind of from the... I read this interview with Ozzy where he was talking about how when they were starting Sabbath, they were doing like blues rock.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what was going on. And then they were seeing the lines for horror movies, and Ozzy was like, why don't we do horror music?
Right.
Like, why don't we try that route?
Right.
And boy, it worked.
Why don't we tune these guitars down and
play
get slow
play
and scary.
Play those evil half steps that were outlawed in the medieval yeah. times because they were so evil.
Yeah, it's great. It's fun. Like, it's theater, you know?
Yeah.
The best metal music, that's why, to me, Guar is so incredible, because they're first of all, each of their records are a self-contained horror sci-fi story. There's a new villain for each record.
Oh, right, yeah.
And even the mythology of Guar, I could talk about this seriously for a long time.
I love that.
But even the mythology of Guar is that there are these aliens from outer space who were frozen in Antarctica, and they've awakened. And so they spawned humans by mating with apes. I mean, it's just amazing. And like all their suits and the blood and the villains. I mean, it's theater, you know?
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's not serious. I don't listen to Guar the way I listen to Leonard Cohen.
No.
But
I hope not.
But music's like food. Like, you don't have to like one kind of thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Some food is more fun. So you had the that was your first band, the Metallica tribute band. What was it called?
Yeah, Soma.
Soma. Okay. Well, so Metallica tribute band named after a deep cut of a Smashing Pumpkins song.
Well, we were also big Smashing Pumpkins fans.
Did you play Smashing Pumpkins too?
Yeah, we played Share a Brock.
Oh,
yeah.
Great song.
One of the best.
I love that guy as a guitar player. In his time, I loved
Billy Corgan.
Yeah, yeah. I just loved his approach. Was different.
No one sounded like him, and he really kind of fucked out his tone with those fuzz pedals,
yeah.
Which was pretty uncool in the 90s. I mean, it was pretty non-grungy. It was like fuzzed out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, they get lumped in with that, but they were in Chicago doing a very different thing.
Yeah, they were doing a different thing. They just happened to play that Lollapalooza that all the other grunge bands were.
Yeah, and he kind of became one of those Eddie Vedder type kind of cult heroes for a kid. I mean, I remember having that Zero shirt that he wore in the Bullet for Butterfly Wings video.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, I was into all that. I had, I think, maybe like 14 or 15 Pearl Jam t-shirts.
Wow.
And all I would wear to school were Pearl Jam shirts, just for every day of the week. And I remember I had this one Pearl Jam shirt that had these Siamese twins on it. And I remember my PE teacher was like, called me up. He's like, he looked at my shirt. He's like, what's going on here? What is this? And I was like, it's just a band. I don't know.
You're in Birmingham, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he just looked at me and he goes, that's disgusting. You know, you're dismissed. Like, he just called me up to tell me my shirt was disgusting, you know?
God, it happens. People are born Siamese twins. You don't have to be so judgy.
I think he's disgusting.
Yeah.
For being an asshole.
How did you get along there? You were wearing Pearl Jam shirts every day. You were in this weird metal band. Did people like you? Where were you in the high school social structure?
I did okay with it.
Yeah.
I was okay. I mean, I always had girlfriends. I had a lot of friends who were like me. There were definitely a group of kids in my school who were the more gothy kids,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, wore baggy JNCOs and liked the band Korn would be an identifying band for them, which I've never been a Korn fan. But even those kids, I was able to get along with because I was always a big Marilyn Manson fan and a big Nine Inch Nails fan.
Yeah.
So I could always find some way to relate to a group of people. I played sports, so I was on a baseball team, I played tennis, I played guitar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't very tough for me.
Was the dream instilled, like after the Kiss concert, were you like, this is going to be my life from now on?
I don't think I ever, when I was young, had a moment like that, like John Lennon seeing Elvis and saying, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
I never really did that. I never really thought it was possible to do that. I just had fun. To me, the dream was just learning AC/DC songs and playing them for my mom. I mean, I remember yelling for my mom to come upstairs and listen to me play Back in Black.
Yeah.
And that was really all I cared about.
Yeah.
I didn't really start taking it seriously as a career until I was like 18 or 19 when I was like, oh, I could really do this.
Did you go to college?
I went to, well, when I first got out of high school, I was in a band that started touring. And then I ended up going to a community college for a couple of years. I did some school, but I was just in bands. I was working in a guitar shop. To me, school didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I like learning. I like the idea of school, but when I was around college age, I was ready to get it cooking on playing music.
Yeah.
And school didn't have a lot to do with that.
And by that time, where were you at musically? Like, what were you listening to? Oh, you know where I played a lot? The Nick.
It used to be my dream to play the Nick.
I bet.
I mean, I remember thinking you talk about making it or dreaming. I used to think, because I got a fake ID, not to buy booze.
To go to the Nick.
Just to go to the Nick. Because there was a really golden age of the Nick where, you know, Whiskey Town was playing the Nick.
Yeah.
It was pre Ryan Adams solo shit. Or like Hank III would be playing the Nick.
I bet the Ugly Americans were playing the Nick.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably.
I was.
I used to go see a really great band there called the Damwells.
Oh, dude.
Which is still a band
I love the Damwells. That guy was just here. I tried to get him on the show. He was here for a couple days writing songs with Marty McGuire. Yeah, Alex Deason.
Mm-hmm.
He was touring with Billy Harvey.
Oh, right. They did that songwriter tour.
With Salim Nirala.
Right.
Yeah.
He wasn't available to come?
No, he had too many things to do. It's too important.
I pre-ordered their new record. I'm getting it on vinyl as soon as it's released. I'm still a huge fan of that band. And I used to see the Damwells at the Nick. 3-4 times a year.
And were they from Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
But he's a Houston guy, though. Alex's, because his sister.
Oh, okay.
I've done shows with his sister, who's married to an old friend of mine. Weird.
Nice.
Small world, yeah.
I think he's in L.A. now. He's a songwriter in L.A. I don't know. But they're back together. All the original members are back together. They just made a new record.
That's great,
so,
man.
I'm stoked. Because they made some records where it was basically just Alex and studio guys, a few Damwells records. And there, I like those records too, but the magic's not there. But I used to dream of the Nick, and I remember the first time I got a headlining gig at the Nick. And the headlining gig at the Nick is awful because it's like, you don't go on till 1 a.m.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's a real seedy, kind of shitty, but beautiful place. And I remember playing that show and being like, well, that's it. I did it. You know, when I was like 18 or 19.
I peaked. That's it. There's nowhere to go.
I did what I wanted to do.
There's nowhere to go from here.
now sign up for college.
Yeah. I had a weird experience. I played with you. You know Ian Moore?
Ian Moore.
Is a guitar. He was a guitar guy in the 90s.
Okay.
Singer-songwriter guy, too.
Okay.
I did a tour playing guitar and keyboards with him, and I had a weird experience at the end of our show with the Nick a friend of mine did with a guy there. He was trying to do some illicit things.
Oh, to who?
No, he was, my friend was trying to procure drugs.
Okay.
I didn't say his name, so that's fine. It wasn't Ian.
The Nick, the Nick is probably in the top 10 places to procure drugs, I would imagine.
Yes, but there was a guy, and our guy was like, our buddy was like, oh, let's just go weed the fan. And so he came out and he was all freaked out. There was the dude that he had done the scene with was threatening his life, and then I think inadvertently threatened all of ours. And so Matt did the transaction and ran out to the van. I was like, go.
Wow. that's like a true rock and roll story.
Yeah,
that's cool. I never did anything like that. The thing that was happening to me at that time, though, 18 and 19, was the Beatles. That was the first time I ever really dove into that shit. And that was like being hit by lightning. You know, I'm sure you're a Beatles guy, right?
Yeah. The only thing is that I grew up on it. So before, I mean, I don't have any memories without those songs playing in the background and being told by my mom and my aunts that there's nothing better than what you're hearing right now. You know what I mean?
They're probably... They're the most successful band in the entire world that's not overrated.
No.
And that's a really bizarre thing. Like, because everyone loves them. When I meet people who don't like the Beatles, I'm like, there's something bizarre about that to me.
There's something really bizarre about that to me, but it's also refreshing. It's nice to know that somebody can go around making music without that specter over their head being like, you'll never do this.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Those records still sound like the future of music.
Sure.
Engineering wise, and they did it with so many limitations. I mean, the songbook of the world. I mean,
yeah.
It's insane. But I never got it. I always thought it was like my image of the Beatles before I was 19 was "I Want to Hold Your Hand," "Love Me Do." I was like, "What? Who cares?"
There's an element of danger that's missing from those guys, and I think you can see it if you go. They're not quite as like goofy as the Beach Boys, but if you go watch the 1964 or 63, either one of those, I think NME Awards, they have them on YouTube. Mm-hmm. You watch the Stones and you watch the Beatles, and you're like, there's a little more like. The Beatles do seem like, I mean, they're amazing, but it almost seems like they work for the man.
Sure.
They're all in the matching suits. They do the simulated ballot. Sure. And the fucking Stones, like, I don't think they even know what's happening. Like, they're on a bunch of speed, and they're like kind of shaking and gyrating, playing these weird blues songs.
Sure. There's the Stones-Beatles discussion I still find really interesting.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, like, when you were into metal and stuff, when you saw the Beatles, that's what you saw.
Oh, right.
It was like, I want to hold your hand.
Sure.
And kind of like, oh, nobody here ever, you know, is going to wind up dead somewhere or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? No danger. You don't get the danger until you get into the music. Then you're like, it's there, but it manifests itself in a completely different way. These guys are like, it's in the kick drum mic is so close to the kick drum. In Tomorrow Never Knows.
Which they never did before that. Like,
right.
It was like an engineering
faux pas.
There's
the danger. You got to really get into it to find that. You don't see it on the NME Awards, but to a kid that's into like Metallica
right.
and fucking Maiden.
True.
You see those guys and you're like, Jesus, these guys have bowl haircuts. They look like dorks.
Well, what happened was my best friend was going through a real heavy phase. And we were listening to Abbey Road. And I think my attitude was just like, oh, Christ. Like, I don't want to listen to Abbey Road. And he was like, I'm going to play you two songs from Abbey Road. Yeah. If you don't like these songs, I'll take it out. And he played me Oh Darling and I Want You. And
this makes my arms stand up. Just talking about it.
I'd never heard them sound so like, and I mean scary in a good way.
Oh, yeah.
But that sort of droning outro of I Want You.
Oh.
And then even Oh Darling, like the drums in it are incredible. Paul's vocal is incredible. I was like, why did
piano
no
one... on Oh Darling is fucking awesome.
Everything about it, that bump, 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 that George shit is so
it's
good.
Fucking brilliant.
I just never heard drums like that on Beatles, guitar like that, singing like that. And that was when I was like, oh, we need to listen to this whole record right now. And I don't think I stopped listening to the Beatles for like 3 years after that car ride. I mean, I think the first one I bought by myself was the White Album. Because I was like, well, it has the most songs, you know?
Yeah.
I'll get the most bang for my buck with the White Album.
Sometimes that's my favorite one, the White Album. I go through, I can never tell you what my favorite Beatles album is because it changes every few months. Yeah.
For me, for a long time, it's been Revolver, but I'm kind of, well, then what happened, so when I first got into the Beatles, I was like, okay, from 65 on, that's my shit, because they were doing drugs and they were far out. But then, once I wore that stuff out, I started going back to meet the Beatles and Beatles for Sale. And No Reply, and like Babies in Black. And I was like, this shit is dark.
Yeah,
I'm a loser. Don't bother me. I mean, even and so as you can probably tell, I got real heavy into the Beatles.
Yeah,
real heavy. And so I started reading all these books about John. Got way into John's solo career. And going back to that early like Please Please Me John stuff, you can see that stuff's dangerous.
Yeah.
When he talks about, like, I'm always the first one to say I love you. Like, using love to get a blowjob. Like,
yeah.
There's all these ideas that song's about oral sex. And, like,
yeah.
I mean, now the early stuff blows my mind as much as the old stuff. To me, their whole deal now is, like, a holistic, complete thing that blows my mind.
Yeah.
You know?
Does it ever blow your mind? Do you ever think you're 31? You ever think, like, by the time they were done?
I used to...
They were doing something else?
Well, so I got into them when I was 19, and I used to think, okay, Paul made Revolver when he was 23.
God damn it.
I have until I'm 23 to do something that great.
Yeah.
And then as I, you know, eclipse 23, then it's like, okay, Paul wrote the second half of Abbey Road when he was 28.
Yeah.
Okay, I have until I'm 28. And yeah, now I'm like, well, they had really great solo careers in the 70s.
You're coming up on No More Lonely Nights pretty soon.
Well,
Paul wrote No More Lonely Nights.
Well, now I'm at like John's Life Begins at 40. Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's the ticket. You know?
Yeah.
But I think it's okay. I think that the work they did warrants the adulation that we have.
Sure.
It's totally okay to be like, they did it. Like, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
It's not, they're not overrated. It's not hype. It's not bullshit. The work is there.
Yeah.
And like the first recorded Feedback. I mean, like so many.
On I Feel Fine?
Yeah, on I Feel Fine. They were the first to do so many cool things.
Oh yeah.
So, I mean, I have lyrics to Strawberry Fields tattooed on my arm. Living is easy with eyes closed. Like, I love them. They're like a part of the fabric of my life for sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that
the weird thing is, it's not what you're saying is like there's more people you can find that it's, or you can, there's less people you can find that it's not the fabric of their lives than. It's rarer to not have them be the fabric of your
life. Right, right.
Than it is to, that's just weird.
It's our parents, us. I mean, my kids, my daughter's going to love it. I mean, it's great music for kids.
Yeah, did you see that Beatle thing on TV and Dave Grohl was like with his daughter and she had like headphones on. Mm-mm. She like stood up and was like, yeah, like all the songs. Like,
no.
Yeah, to me, that's like, I didn't grow up, like my parents were born in Cuba and they were young. When they had me here, and they didn't know, like, I'd never heard like John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt or any of that shit when right. I was a kid until I like went to school and all these kids are like singing these even like shit like Row 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 Your Eyes. You didn't know that right. shit.
So your songs knew, were Beatles.
Yeah, my parents were young. My dad was, you know, he kind of was singing in a band and stuff then, and so it was like, you know, that's yeah.
Well, I mean, Yellow Submarine and Obladi Oblada. It's like
yeah, that's
great
the best
kids.
Kid music you've ever seen.
It's great for kids, and it is cheekier and nerdier than the Stones,
sure.
But in that way, it's a little bit more universal.
Yeah,
and I like that. But don't get me wrong, when my image of the Stones being just badass motherfuckers, like I love that image.
Yeah,
I mean, I love Let It Bleed and Exile on Main Street, and I love the grit of it.
Yeah.
But I also like the idea of the Beatles kind of being nerds, like kind of upper middle class nerds, who just happen to be genius songwriters.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that shit got dark. I mean, the White Album is a dark record.
Yeah.
Let It Be is a dark record.
Your Blues is a...
Your Blues?
That's as dark as it gets.
And talk about guitar playing, that one note thing that John does. To me, my favorite electric guitar player in the world is Neil Young.
Yeah.
So that sort of fucked up, I'm just going to hit one note forever, that inspires me more than, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan or a virtuoso type guitar player. You know,
yeah,
I saw sure. a guy interview Neil Young once, and because on Down by the River, there's like a 16-bar solo where he just hits this one
yeah.
note. And the interviewer was like, what's the deal with you hitting that one note? Was that intentional? And Neil Young's just like, to me, that was 100 different notes. That was not one note,
yeah.
you know? I love that.
It's the one he's doing the Bigsby at the
yeah.
same
thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know which one you're doing.
It's
I
just
know
a,
the note.
It's a thing. It's an event. He made the guitar. It wasn't like, oh, look at my guitar solo. It was like, I'm going to fuck the universe up right now. And it doesn't, you know what I mean? It doesn't
yeah.
take a lot of dexterity.
Yeah. So when you were doing the Beatle thing, were you in a band? Were you trying to start a band? Were you being a guitar guy
yeah,
for
I,
hire?
Yeah, I was in a cover band. I joined a
okay,
cover
that's
band
the band
when
you
I was,
were talking about.
But I joined the band when I was 16 and I was in the band till I was 26. So that was kind of my main thing. And then I started just getting hooked up with local singer-songwriter type dudes and kind of doing that, like not the cover band, but actually playing original music with people, but always as a side guy. And then kind of dabbling in songwriting, but I realized pretty quick that I liked playing guitar for a lot of different people, doing a lot of different kinds of music.
Rather than the pressure of being the artist having to do this
yeah.
thing. It's, yeah, there's definitely a different...
I don't envy my friends who are artists. I mean, especially nowadays, my artist friends are having to work really hard to make it work.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, though. With all the songs that you have on SoundCloud, I mean, you've got a really beautiful voice and...
Thanks.
I mean, I'm assuming you can play and sing at the same time pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
you don't ever go down to, like... maybe not the Bluebird, but to, like, you know, solo acoustic
No, I this is going to sound pretentious, but I have a manager, and she's specifically managing me with my songwriting.
Because oh, really?
Because I want to be a career songwriter.
Oh, right. Of course. And you live in the town where
right.
that's going
and
on.
And when I'm not touring, I'm co-writing with songwriters every day. Sometimes
you are?
Twice a day. Yeah. Every day. I'm taking it pretty seriously. So just trying to get cuts on records, trying to meet people, being a career songwriter. And she's been encouraging me to go perform my songs at songwriters' nights. So I may start doing that. I don't know. I don't have a lot of interest in it. But I like writing songs. I like it a lot. I'll always write songs.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
That, I mean, so have you written with anyone Have you gotten to write with Luke Bryan?
Well, I don't know how many people get to write with him. I do have some friends who are getting cuts on his records. But at that level, it's so bizarre. There's such a huge machine of how those songs get picked. When you're someone like Luke Bryan, you know, they're very strategic about the shit that goes on records.
Sure.
It's not like calling him up and writing a song with him.
Sure, of course not.
And then so the key to that, if you want to be a songwriter, is just getting in on a co-write that's that high profile. And you have to have a name and have had some cuts under your belt to even get into those situations.
Yeah.
So I'm writing with a lot of people who are still making indie records. I'm writing with people who have licensing deals where they're writing songs that are being put on Grey's Anatomy. You know, things like that. So I wrote with a friend of mine has a publishing deal with Sony. And we went and wrote the other day. And they actually have a Who's Looking list of like...
Oh, right.
Kelly Clarkson's looking for a song about... She just had a kid and she's looking for a very specific kind of song. So me and him wrote a song about being a 32-year-old mother, you know, like very much like a craftsman's way of looking at songwriting.
Sure. I participate in that.
I love it.
I've done that not my whole time, but like since the 90s, since the late 90s, I've been at a deal with Warner Chappell for a while.
Cool.
And there's a company here called Hamstein that courted me and sent me on a lot of writing projects.
Nice.
I love doing that.
I do too. I think that some people don't. Some people have a pretty weird view of it.
No, I asked Bob to write a song once, and he said, "Why? That's like coming over and watching me take a shit." That's what he said.
Me and him wrote songs. We've written a couple of songs together because I tell him all the time. I'm like, people would love to write. You need to co-write. You need to be co-writing with Marty and Billy Harvey and Patty Griffin.
Those women would come to his shows. I mean, they come to his shows.
Yeah.
They fucking take him out on tour.
Yeah.
They want to write songs with him.
Well, it's funny because
I thought he did.
I think he helped them write a song, and I don't think he liked the experience. Because I think maybe his sort of inclination was to try to fuck it up, you know, the way that Bob does.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're collaborating with someone, less of that's happening. You're not really wanting to throw a big wrench into a song. You're wanting to open a song up. So it's a little bit of a disposition thing. But I like that about Bob. I mean, he really does approach it the way an artist does. Whereas I approach it more, I would hope that it's more as a craftsperson. Like, I like crafting a song. I like assignment writing.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I love Carole King and Randy Newman, who did great work as artists.
Great stuff comes out of that stuff. You know, it doesn't have to be soulless.
Yeah, who says? I mean, who says it should be soulless? Like,
a lot of people sometimes say that. They're like, I don't want to do that. It's just totally soulless or whatever.
I think they're just wrong about it. I don't know. I think that songwriting is a craft. And if you wait to write a song like to be inspired or have a muse, that shit doesn't happen every day.
No. I, being around Bob this whole time, there's always like that shit, man. You know, he's just fucking writing that many songs. I mean, he writes a lot of songs. And maybe also when you go and write with someone, maybe the pressure of having that song be something. When he writes so many songs, he's basically just throwing them out. But then when you go back and look through them, you're like, oh, a gem. Here's a gem. Oh, right. Let me fix this and it'll be a gem.
Right.
Where you're going to like write this one song has all this pressure on it.
Right.
I could see how that would probably be really uncomfortable if you're super prolific like that.
Yeah. I mean, some of the writing I do with people, there's a lot of pressure on it. But I feel like, I'm trying to write, if I'm not out on tour, I want to write 5 songs a week. I want to write 2 a day. And they're not all going to be great, but it's just a song. It's just a 3-minute song. Or I'll have some people who will be really intense about, what do we want to say today?
Yeah.
Well, who cares? Like, it's a song.
Start saying something and you'll see what you're saying.
Just write
something.
That's
what you want to say.
Yeah. Well, why do we have to say something all the time?
Yeah.
I like songs that say things. I like protest songs. I like Bob Dylan. But I also like I like Red Hot Chili Peppers, where who knows what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
How that's funny about protest and like political. I mean, I did it, when I was in my late teens, because it was the late 80s and whatever, and there was apartheid and all that stuff to stand up against. But I feel so disingenuous trying to write something like that.
Yeah, it's a fine line with how it comes off, for sure.
Some guys can really do it. Like, Bruce Springsteen can write a song and really, like, express his discontent with something in a really beautiful and positive way without sounding like he's preaching to you.
He would be a great example of that. But yeah. I think his best work are his personal songs.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
Yeah, I love Born in the USA.
Yeah.
But I'd rather hear anything off Nebraska.
Yeah.
You know?
So let's talk about guitar guys, man. You're into some cool guys. You were saying that you were trying to get a sound like Johnny Marr.
Yeah, I love Johnny Marr.
That's amazing. That's one of my favorite guys.
It's funny, if you go read interviews with him now, and when he gets asked about how he got some of those sounds, he doesn't even know. You know what I mean? Like he was asked about that tremolo sound on How Soon Is Now. Sure. And he was like, I don't know what we... That was just such a time that was like on fire for them. They were just in the fucking flame, making that stuff to where there is a sense where you're in this cloud of doing work where you can come out of it and be like, man, I don't even know how we did that. I've heard songs that I've written from like 3 years ago in the song game with this weird sound on it or something where I'm like, I don't even know how I did that.
Yeah, I have that too sometimes.
And Bob and I talk about this in songwriting all the time where he talks about 40 Dogs and he's like, people like that song a lot. He's like, I don't even know if I could do that again.
Yeah, I have that. Yeah.
Because it is a mysterious, weird thing that comes and goes. It's really hard to just say, oh, well, dissect that. Well, this is how 40 Dogs was made. John Lennon talks about that for Across the Universe because it's in a weird time.
Yeah.
And he was asked, like, how did you come up with using that time signature? And he's like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I was just strumming and singing.
And they're like, well, it's in this, like, 5/4 thing. And he's like, I couldn't even do that again if you paid me to. I heard it in a dream. I just did it.
Yeah.
You know? And so, it's funny hearing Johnny Marr talk about that in terms of guitar tone. Like, it applies to everything creative.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Who else do you... obviously, Daniel Lanois, you like his guitar playing and what he does with the space.
I love Neil Young. I love David Gilmour. Who else do I love? I don't think about guitar players very often. I like songwriters a lot more. I like bands.
Yeah,
I love Angus Young.
Yeah,
I love Slash. I mean,
I love Slash too. I love to hear him play.
He's great. He's just there's something really different about him and special in a way that none of those other '80s kind of glammy bands.
Yeah, really, he's got some magic.
Yeah, there's something really. You know that it's him playing.
Yeah.
Whereas in that decade, and especially in that genre of music.
He wasn't tied into that faceless sort of post-Eddie Van Halen guitar playing.
Right,
like a Warren D. Martini. Like, people talk about, I'm just saying his name because I know it, but the guy from Rat, like, people are like, oh, that guy's a guitar hero. And you're like, he's just kind of like, there's no... When I hear him, I don't know it's him, but I can hear Slash playing on somebody else's song and go, like, is that Slash?
You could play me a Rat song and a Scorpion song, the guitar solos, and I would not be able to tell you what band that you could play a Striper song and I wouldn't know.
Tell the difference between Warren D. Martini and Matthias Jabs.
I couldn't, dude, but I sure as hell could tell the difference between Slash and Mick Marr.
Yeah,
you know, so I've always loved that, and I always loved Axl. I've always loved enigmatic, weird frontmen. I was a huge in the early 90s. I was a huge Axl Rose, Michael Jackson, Eddie Vedder guy. I love those guys. three dudes.
Yeah, very iconic.
They just were dark and weird and interesting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I like them more than the guitar players in their bands.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I get that. Slash bums me out.
Why?
I mean, not Slash bums me out. Axl bums me out.
Oh, yeah.
He just bums me out.
Yeah, well...
He just can't... There's too much him in his world. Something happened with that guy.
Well, he's definitely not well. He's definitely insane.
No.
But that's kind of what's great about him. I will say that my wife and I, she's also a very big Guns N' Roses fan, and we went and saw the new Guns N' Roses. They played in Nashville.
With Buckethead?
No. This is he had Tommy Stinson, and he has these other dudes. The only original member in the band was Dizzy Reed, the keyboard player from Use Your Illusions. But, dude, they came out on time. And played for 3 hours. We had to leave because it was like we were tired.
Yeah, they wore you out.
And it kicked ass. I mean, it wasn't magic. I mean, it wasn't like seeing Slash and Izzy Stradlin and Duff McKagan play Mr. Brownstone.
Yeah.
I mean, it did kind of seem like a cover band. But it was great. I thought it was cool. And I will say that as insane as Axl is, and he's definitely insane, sometimes I see interviews with him or like I read his letter about not going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm like, I get where this dude's coming from. Like, sometimes I
didn't like that letter, made me mad.
Well, I just felt like what he was saying was, hey, look, I'm in a band with dudes that I feel good about. I'm healthy. We're making music we believe in. We're on a tour that I love. We've finally put out this record I've worked so hard on. I don't want to take a break from that to come be in a situation with people that I don't have pleasant memories of or feelings about.
Right.
I'm proud of Guns N' Roses. I'm happy that we're being inducted. I'm proud of the work. But,
I guess so, yeah.
But I would rather not attend. And I'm definitely not going to play. And I'm like, that sounds as reasonable as you can be if you're insane.
Yeah. I guess so, yeah, considering the source.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do I wish that he was normal and could just be with those dudes and make a great record? Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
He bums me out, too, in that sense, that he just had to pile drive that shit when it was, to me, Guns is a real magical, those three records.
Definitely.
Greatest debut rock record of all time.
Yeah.
Although I did prefer Matt Sorum to Steven Adler, but I get shit on for having that opinion. That's a really unpopular opinion in rock and roll.
Oh, Matt's a great drummer. That was a weird thing to say. He is a great drummer. Matt Sorum is a great drummer.
I like that.
He's more than a great drummer.
I like that you said his first name as if like, no, Matt's cool. Matt's a good drummer, man.
I've actually met him and hung out with him.
Really?
Yeah, I was signed to a label that was owned by Lars Ulrich.
Oh,
for a few years.
What was that?
It was called The Music Company. It was under Elektra.
Okay, cool.
But I was around him because the Camps knew each other. The guy that ran the label for Lars, ran his personal label, was the guy that was, he was a tour accountant for Metallica, and he was the tour accountant on that show in Toronto or whatever when Axl wouldn't play, when James burnt himself.
When there was like a riot.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing stories from his end, like stuffing cash into guitar cases and amp cases and trying to get it out before the promoters came back to get their money back, and like being downstairs in the backstage watching the riot on CNN and not being able to leave the venue because of that. Pretty weird. I got to meet Sorum because I got to go and see The Cult when he was playing with
them. Oh, yeah, The Cult.
Yeah, in 1999 a couple times.
Was that 99? He was in The Cult before then,
but he was in The Cult in 1999, which is when they got their deal again. It was right before they got their deal, and he cut his hair.
Okay.
You a Cult fan?
Yeah, yeah. Fire Woman, She Sells Sanctuary. Yeah.
I like all that stuff a lot. I like Billy Duffy as a guitar player.
Yeah.
Did you ever get into shoegazer stuff? Like any kind of weird English
I've never really
music?
Known what bands fall under that category.
My Bloody Valentine?
No.
Ride?
No. I like the phrase shoegazer rock.
Yeah.
But I don't really know what that means. What does it mean?
It's like the guitars are real loud and swirly.
Swirly.
And the vocals are real low and meek.
Hmm.
And it's just like this onslaught of guitars, but they're not like junk junk. It's like this dreamy kind of like. Do you ever listen to the Cocteau Twins?
No. You need to make me a mixtape.
Yeah, I think I do.
I like everything you're saying.
Yeah.
I like big swirly guitars.
Yeah, the Cocteau Twins were kind of this 80s weird English band with like this girl that sang in like a weird made up language or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like Sigur Rós.
Yeah, those guys. Wow, are they still doing? Yeah, they are still doing stuff. Aren't they?
I don't keep up with them. I would never in a million years go see them live or anything. But you know, I bought when they were having. I guess when they were kind of getting some buzz.
When they first came out.
Well, there's that Parentheses record, that white record, which I think is like their third or fourth record.
Right.
That's just beautiful. It's just a great record to put on. It's funny, whenever I listen to like Sigur Rós, I also listen to like Sade, you know? Like they fall into that world with me.
You know what's funny with me is like I'll listen to like Sigur Rós or something like that and I'll be like, fuck, I want to make music like that. But I have such a structural thing in like songwriting structure thing in place inside of me that like I can't do it. Like songs have to have bridges and choruses.
The best songs do have those things. Yeah. I mean, listening to an 8-minute ambient song in a made up Icelandic language is real cool when you're younger. But
it's cool. It's cool to me because to me it's like I mean, just to be able to get out of your head and do something right. that's so different. It's not even English.
It's very free, for sure. But it's not music you pay attention to. It's not music you put on while you're doing anything else. Yeah. It's not like, you know, putting in a Paul Simon record and like really wanting to hear every bit of it because you want to know how he made that beautiful song, you know?
Yeah.
Did you ever get into Paul Simon?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I got into Paul Simon. I was into Paul Simon the whole time, I think.
Yeah.
I've never really gotten out of him.
Yeah. He's another dude where, like, people who... I can't imagine someone saying, I don't like Paul Simon. I can't even imagine it. I can imagine...
What about it don't... Like, you'd have to be, like, into Junk Junk, and that's it, because there's none of that in Simon's thing. He's never going to scream.
You would have to
be...
He's not
going to raise his voice at you.
You would have to be in a real serious underground, you know, Norwegian death metal... click to hate Paul Simon, I guess. But but I listen to Norwegian death metal. And
do you?
I listen to any metal. I love metal. I love it. I listen to it probably more than anything these days.
Really?
Yeah.
I was reading something fun. Like Ryan Adams is into the same music.
Yeah, he's a big metal freak, I think.
But like Norwegian death metal specifically, he's like, that's all I listen to.
I wouldn't. Like that. I definitely get worn out by that kind of stuff. But I like more pop. I mean, you know, Metallica is probably the Beatles of metal.
That's really weird. Right?
In that they just write recognizable like classic songs with big hooks that everyone knows.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yeah, they're like the, you know, more so than the Megadeth or someone, you know.
Yeah. I have a song that's me and Lars and Amy Mann.
I love Amy Mann. So what's going on there? Who wrote the song?
I wrote the song. And Lars didn't like the way our drummer played on it, and he offered his services like this. He said, "Oh, his drums are too fucking tight on this song. It's so Bill Leffler ruined the song." You know Bill?
No.
He's friends with Bob. He's the guy that helped like started Lonely Land with Bob.
Okay.
And he was our drummer, and he was like,
"You do a pretty good Lars impression."
Thanks. I had a lot to work with. He's like, "Dude, we gotta get a different. We need a better drum. Someone sloppy. That's what I need is to put in someone. Let's get someone sloppy in there." And I was like, "Me?" And he goes, "No, dude, me." And I was like, "Oh my God. It's like a slow waltz."
And did he?
It is the worst shit you've ever heard. I went to record it with him. Like, I took the tapes. And I mean, I don't know if he'll listen to this episode. But I don't think he listens to my show. But
you never know.
I had to tell him no after we did it. But he was like, "Look, why don't you just come up to San Francisco?" They were mixing the S&M album at the time. You know what I'm talking about? Like the thing that they did with the...
Huge fan of that record. Okay. Yeah, with the San Francisco Symphony, with Michael Kamen.
Yes. And so they're mixing that with Bob Rock. And he goes, "You know, Bob and I will take a night and a day to work on some stuff with you." And so I was like, okay. And so there was... I got there, and I went to that Sausalito studio.
Their headquarters?
The record plant or whatever that
is. Oh, okay, yeah.
Back then.
Sure.
This is like 99. Anyway, long story short, I go in, he's playing the drums, and I met Bob Rock. I sat behind him, and he's like, what do you think of this? And he turned around, and he looked at me, and he goes, my eyes must have been like this big, and I was just like, this isn't just some guy playing drums on my thing. It's also the guy that gives me my money.
Right.
And is putting my fucking record out. So I'm in a pretty weird position. So Bob Rock read my face and said, "Don't worry, man. I know just what to do." He had to speed up the track for Lars. And the way that he explained to Lars what he was doing was actually pretty amazing. And I bet it's probably something people would want to see. Because obviously you're not going to tell Lars you can't. You can't play this. You're terrible at playing this slow, and it's not working out. He was like, "I'm going to speed it up, so that way when you hit the cymbals, it'll be like..."
Right. He knows how to produce Lars.
And he's like, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's great, Bob. Let's do that." He's
like, knows how to produce him.
Yeah, but it's still pretty weird. And then me and him and Bob hung out, and man, I don't have the recordings of the jams that we did, but Bob on bass... Lars on drums and me on guitar.
That's wild. That would be a dream come true for me. Even if it sounded
bad. It's pretty weird. He plays... He is the drummer of Metallica.
Right.
No matter what he's doing.
Well, that's interesting because they're a great example. And I think it's all of them, not just Lars, of where they do their thing almost as good as anyone could do it, but that's all they can do.
Yeah.
Like, they're not a versatile band.
No.
And, but one of the cool things about them is you can see in that, you've seen that documentary, right? Yeah. The Some Kind of Monster. Mm-hmm. One of the best rock and roll documentaries of all time.
Yeah.
And you can see them trying to get out of their thing, making that awful record, and you can just see them failing at it.
Yeah.
And I remember what I used to say at the time when that record came out. I said, this is one of the worst records ever made by a great band.
Yeah.
You know, a really great band just made a really shitty record. Because they just needed to go back and do the thing. And then the record they made after that with Rick Rubin, Death Magnetic.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're hip to that record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They tried to, they just did Injustice for All Part 2. And yeah. It's fucking incredible.
Yeah.
I remember I was married to my first wife at the time. When I got that record, she was already asleep at our house in Birmingham. And I was so filled with joy when I heard the first song. I cranked it, woke her up. She comes out upset. You know, what are you doing? And I was like, they're back. I was like, they're back. They're still great.
Yeah.
That they just made a weird record because they tried to do something different.
Yeah.
And she's just like, are you out of your fucking mind? Turn it down. Yeah. I don't care that they're back. You know?
I like that I like them.
I do too.
I like him. He was so nice to me and believed in me so much. It was pretty unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like he would say these weird, kind of almost romantic things like, dude, when I look at you, I just fucking like, it's like you were made in the rock star factory.
Well, like, I think they were weird guys to begin with, but just think about the life they've lived over the last 35 years. Just the, and what that has to do to your mind.
Yeah.
The fame, the success, like, all the traveling. Yeah. I mean, that's got to be a trip, you know?
Yeah. And the control, like, the fact that they did it all themselves. That's why, I mean, I wasn't a Metallica fan. And I honestly, when I heard that his label was, like, really interested in signing our band, I was like, this is never going to... Why in the fuck would he want me? You know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, he has versatile tastes, but he's still that guy.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, they're all like that.
Yeah. But the other guys weren't... Kirk and James weren't that warm... Jason was really nice.
Yeah.
Very cool. But even he thought he was playing the blues all the time. He'd be like, oh, yeah, dude, I did this blues thing tonight. And you're like, oh, my God, dude. Like, you know where I'm from? Like,
I know.
I don't even play blues just because I don't want to get the fuck kicked out of me by Denny Freeman or something.
I mean, yeah, they're not musically deep.
No.
You know?
Although, or broad.
Broad.
Yeah.
They're deep in, because I remember when the Garage Inc. shit came out and they're just doing all this... All these really cool old songs that I'd like Bread Fan and
yeah.
doing some really cool shit and they were the ones that got me into Thin Lizzy, you know?
Yeah.
And that's in that world, in that rock world, Thin Lizzy is as good as it gets. I mean.
Oh yeah. Dude, people that grew up in Europe, like Europe hard rock metal people, like Deep Purple and Thin Lizzy those are the fucking guys.
Yeah. And in Thin Lizzy, just the dual guitar playing. Yeah. I mean, and the songs. The songs are incredible. They were great songwriters. So, yeah, they're deep in that way. But, yeah, the blues, no.
No.
Although, you know, those Load and Reload records are kind of bluesy. You know, they're definitely not metal records. And that's why people hate them.
Right.
I love them. They're probably my favorite ones.
Yeah. I like that song, Fuel, a lot.
Fuel kicks ass. That's track one on Reload.
There you go. Load and Reload.
Load and Reload.
I didn't grow up with them. I remember there was a guy in high school with a shirt that said "Metal Up Your Ass."
And yeah,
it was a dagger coming out of a toilet.
Yeah.
I just thought, like, who the fuck would listen to that shit band?
I love that. Like, I want that poster up in my studio, like right now. I told my wife, I was like, my idea of success is to just be successful enough to wear a Slayer shirt every day, and it not have
you
any
Slayer
consequence.
Guy too?
Oh yeah.
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 What's your studio like? What do you got? What do you have? Obviously, do you have a lot of guitars? Do you have a big collection?
No, I don't. I have an ES-335 that I do almost all my work on. It's got a big Bixby on it. It's warm and dark and beautiful. And then I have a nice Telecaster, and that's it. I have a couple of nice acoustics.
What about your grandpa? Is he still around?
He's still around. He still has all those guitars. I bought the two acoustics I have, which are pretty badass acoustics, he gave me.
Oh, that's cool.
When I was like 18 or 19, I wanted to go buy a guitar from him. And some of the people in my family, I think, expect him to give them things sometimes. I don't want to be too weird about that. But I went to him and said, hey, I've got $1,800. I want to buy one of your guitars. I want like the family discount, but I want to buy one. I want to buy one of your J200s because he had a bunch. He's like, well, go pick one out. Sure, go pick one out. And I was able to pick between like five or six J200s. I picked this and I was like, I want this like Emmylou Harris Grand Ole Opry. I got this big blonde J200. It's my main acoustic. I gave him the $1,800, said bye. I was pulling out of the driveway and he runs out to meet me and he shook my hand and gave me my money back, which is pretty cool.
That's really cool.
It meant a lot to him that I wanted to buy it. So I don't know if he just really dug that, but about 2 or 3 months later, he called me and said, hey, I've got this 1967 Rosewood D28. It's the last year they made them with Brazilian Rosewood. It's a really nice guitar. And he's like, would you be interested in, do you want it, you know? I'm like, fuck yeah, I want that guitar.
Jesus.
So he gave me that guitar too. Those are my two acoustics.
That's amazing.
And he's still got some great stuff. I don't need any more. But we still talk about it, and, you know, we still talk about guitars. And then for recording, I had a MacBook Pro, Logic, and Inbox. That's it. I have a keyboard. I don't have a lot of gear. I wish I had more, but I don't. I play an AC30 and a deluxe reverb. I have 2 amps, 2 electrics, 2 acoustics.
What are you using on this Bob tour? Like for amp, AC30 or the...
Well, because I live in Nashville and I fly here, I can't use one of my amps. So I actually use, it's an amp that Mesa Boogie gave Bob, a Lone Star, which is not an amp I would play in a million years. But it's really cool. It's a really cool amp. It has an attenuator in it, so it does 30 watts, 15 watts, and 5 watts. It's a really versatile, cool amp.
That's nice.
So that's just always at Bob's house, so that's what's going to go in the bus.
It's good.
Yeah.
How's he, do you like, obviously you work with him a lot and you like working with him.
Yeah.
How often do you get to tour with him? He calls you and says, hey, I got this, and then you either can do it or not.
Yeah, and I prioritize his gigs for sure.
Okay.
But we don't do a lot. We do a couple of 2 week runs. We do maybe 3 or 4 2 week runs a year.
Wow. So he's slowed down a lot.
Yeah.
On the big touring. The rest of the time he's just Texas.
Because he does so well in Texas. Saxon. He doesn't have a lot of incentive to. Well, he also does, I mean, like, he does the whole Texas market all the time. Dallas, Houston, Lubbock, San Antonio. So if there are bigger Texas shows, I'll come in and do maybe 3 or 4 of those. But for the most part, I don't do the Texas shows.
Okay.
So I do his records with him. We tour a couple, you know, do a couple of tours a year. I love it. I love working with him.
And
I love
the songwriting band.
I'm in the songwriting game.
He's
with
a great guy.
Yeah.
He gets a weird rap here in town. I would say 75% because he's doing more than everyone. And
right. That
kind of, I think, rubs everyone the wrong way. When you want to be viewed as like the best at what you do, there's this guy that's just working circles around you all the time. And I can see how that would build up resentment.
Sure.
But then the other 25% is because his resting face is not a smile. So people think he's a jerk. When he's not, he's a really nice guy.
I can see that.
He's a really nice guy.
He's been really generous to me, and he's been a sweet guy to me.
He's been very sweet to me, too.
And we've actually become pretty good friends. And so, I mean, we talk when we're not working together.
That's good.
And when I'm in town, I stay at his house. I mean, we go see movies. I mean, we're buds, you know?
I feel a little intimidated. We've been supposed to be doing one of these, I think, all summer. We were talking about it, and then sometimes I just feel like he's busy and I'm bothering him. I probably shouldn't be like that. But I really feel like he's my famous friend that, like, I think about it before. Like, sometimes I find shit, like, I found some self-affirmation box in a SkyMall magazine when I was flying somewhere.
Yeah.
And it had this personal affirmation box, and the name that the default name that they used was Bob, and they were like, the description read like, Bob has a legion of fans that can't always be there to cheer him on. And also, which I thought was so weird and funny and appropriate, I sent him a copy of that and told him I wanted to get him that for his birthday.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I didn't. But wow. Anyway,
so people would buy that box, like, whatever your name is,
I guess. Yeah, you'd put your name in there. It wouldn't just be Bob,
and it just tells you nice things about yourself.
Yeah, like, hey, you're doing a great job, Bob. hey, Bob, have a good day. Or in your case, Clint. Nice song, Clint.
Well, I don't want to disparage anyone that really is benefited by that, but what a weird thing. What a sad place to be to look to that.
Everything in Sky Mall, though, is kind of... I mean, there's stuff that's just unbelievably awesome that you've never seen before that you can't believe there's that and you really want it. That and do you really need an actual size Sasquatch for your yard?
Right.
Or a zombie coming out of the ground. Right.
The life-size gnome.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's addictive looking through that Sky Mall.
Totally. Dude, it's one of my favorite things about flying places.
Or like I was looking at it the other day and this... Some of the scary shit where they're like, buy this pin that's also a hidden video camera and spy on your spouse.
Like that stuff,
I'm like, well, I like the idea that I'm like, that's cool. But then I'm like, who the fuck is using that on me? Like, this microphone might have a camera in it. I don't know. That's horrifying. You can just buy that, right?
I don't know if people actually buy. That's the other thing. Is like everything in Sky Mall is stuff that like
who's buying it. I would love to see a documentary about the people who like when you go in their house, you're like
a Sky Mall freak.
It's like all Sky Mall.
Yeah.
Well, did you see that episode of Parks and Rec where Aziz Ansari, they go camping and everything is Sky Mall.
Yeah.
It's pretty brilliant. Pretty good.
I love that dude. There was something I was going to ask you, but I just so you're a dad.
I'm a dad. Yeah.
And you are married.
Yep, married.
And she does?
My wife has a full-time job working in Nashville, so...
What does she do?
She works for a... Let me get this right.
Okay.
It's a lobbying group for small businesses.
Oh, that's cool.
And so she works there, like, on the phones, dealing with sales representatives who work for small businesses. It's office work. It's cool. It's easy. It's nice because her side of shit is real stable.
Right.
It makes a lot of sense. And then my side is chaotic, and I'm never know 2 months out what I'm going to do.
Right.
Which I kind of thrive on.
I mean, that's a tough thing for.
Yeah, I'm often surprised that she's duking it out with me for sure. You know, it's tough. It's probably really tough to be married to someone like me.
Yeah. Any of us.
And I listen to I buy Pantera vinyl, and that's got to be real tough to live with.
I would think what you need to do is take her to their strip club.
To whose strip club?
Pantera's.
Oh, they have a strip club?
Yeah, in Dallas.
In Dallas?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
The Abbott Brothers? Is it a Dimebag and Vinny Paul's?
Well, yeah, I think it's Vinny's.
Because Phil Anselmo lives in New Orleans, I think.
Yeah.
So you think that I should just take my wife to their strip clubs?
She'd love them.
And then she'd be a fan.
Wow. They're really into golf. It's like a golf-themed strip club. It's not a metal...
What?
Yeah, it's all golf stuff. Like pictures of the Three Stooges playing golf. And
I bet a lot of people in Dallas play golf.
Yeah.
That's probably a golfing city.
Bob plays golf, doesn't he? You play golf?
I don't play golf. I don't have a problem with it, but I definitely
I got invited
don't.
To play a tournament last year, this Hooters... A friend of mine lost his partner and was like, you don't do anything in the weekdays, so come play golf with me at this tournament. And if there's chicks in bathing suits giving out beer at every hole and like a gift bag with a lot of stupid shit, but I enjoy a gift bag.
Sure.
I would go golfing all the time, but it's nothing like that. Apparently
I'd just be a caddy.
Yeah.
I'll hand you the golf club you need.
That's good. I did get it though. I spent the day trying to hit the ball, you know, and then I did it, and I hit the ball right. And
feel good?
I got the whole golf thing. Like, I did. I got it.
You got that one good stroke.
No, but I got all of like the obsession with golf. Like, I'm going to – it's you versus yourself, and you're just trying to play better than you ever have every time, and it's very interesting.
I just learned that it takes a long time to play golf.
Yeah.
I thought golf maybe took an hour or two.
Oh, no, but golf takes all day.
It's all day.
Yeah.
So – it just sheds new light on my friends who grew up and their dads were like playing golf twice a week. It's like, oh, like your dad was like gone.
Yeah.
Your dad was gone every weekend, all weekend.
Yeah.
You know, big golf dads.
Yeah. Golf dads.
Maybe I'll turn into a golf. Maybe I'll just play golf.
You have a daughter?
I do have a daughter. Yeah.
They play golf too. It's not like football or something. You know what I mean?
Maybe that's what I'll do for the rest of my life is just play one unending game of golf.
Yeah, just one game.
In a Slayer t-shirt.
Constant game of golf. I don't think they allow you to wear that stuff. I had to wear like a button-down shirt and all this shit.
See, that's another thing they hate about golf. The dress code?
Yeah.
What do they care what you wear?
I don't know.
My new mission is to be successful enough to wear a Slayer shirt every day on a fucking golf course.
I went through that. I went through a thing like that. I decided that at one point I was important enough in my own mind to always wear sneakers and a t-shirt everywhere I went. Who cares? Even a fancy restaurant.
Yeah. I think that's great.
Yeah.
I think the world needs a little more Axl Rose. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. The world needs a little more of that kind of swagger. Especially in rock music.
Yeah. There was a place here in the 90s and 80s called Steamboat. And they had t-shirts that said, remember when rock and roll... Wait, when sex was safe and rock and roll was dangerous?
Right. Yeah, that's cool.
That was probably a good time. That was way before you. You came into this rock and roll and sex.
Well, no one makes rock and roll. Everyone only plays guitar because they wanted to get laid.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
That's a fact.
That's been proven.
Yeah.
If you give me a sheet of paper and a, you know,
abacus. Was her name Shyla? Who's the girl that you called and played Glycerine to?
Shayna. And, you know, I think at that point, I might have been a little too young to be thinking necessarily about sex, but I definitely wanted to impress a girl with a guitar.
You thought you'd call her and she would just, like...
She would
have that Beatles moment, like...
I guess I thought that she would hear Glycerine played instrumentally on the phone and say, this is what I'm missing, is a dude like this. And I guess I thought the next day at school, it'd be like an immediate couple. I don't know what I thought. I have no idea what I was thinking. But I like that story, though.
Yeah, me too, man. Me too.
Because that dude is now buried.
I know. Yeah, underneath. Think about that dude, too. Like, I had a dude like that when I was, like, 15, yeah. 16.
Yeah.
I would never think to do any of that stuff anymore.
I mean, I used to shamelessly, not hit on because you're so young, but, like, I remember, like, buying... getting like in the quarter machine, like at a grocery store, getting some earrings and painting them silver with like a silver Sharpie and giving them to a girl in third grade.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was like, these are paint. She like saw that.
Yeah. 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 These aren't real.
She was like, this isn't real silver.
It's the thought.
But that dude is cool.
Yeah. That dude is real cool.
Like, I love that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I bet that dude's still around. That's what your wife sees.
Yeah, and the older I get, the more in tune I get with that guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I was most removed from that guy when I was maybe 21.
Sure.
But now I realize that dude's probably the dude I want to be.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. This guy's got some soul.
Yeah, some balls, some courage.
Yeah.
And is a shameless lover. You know?
Yeah.
Wants to just be in love.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't gross or creepy either. It was like pure.
Yeah, it was genuine.
Playing Glycerine and not even singing it. Why didn't I sing it? I just thought playing it would be impress her.
You might have felt a little self-conscious about your voice.
I don't even think I thought about singing it. I don't know. Just the idea didn't happen. Wow. That I should sing it too.
Well, if people want to hear you singing, they can go to ClintWellsMusic.com, and there's a SoundCloud link on there. You're on Twitter. That's how we got to...
Big on the Twitter, big on the Instagram.
Yeah, those are good.
The Instagram is basically just daily pictures of my vinyl collection, which some people really dig.
I dig them. I need to up my vinyl collection. I was listening to Bob Schneider on vinyl when you showed up today.
Yeah, that's one of my... It's always fun to hear work you've done on vinyl, for sure. I love that. The next record's going to be on vinyl, too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you don't have any plans. I think people should go listen to those songs of yours on SoundCloud. I think if they just know you as a guitar player, or they just know you from this conversation,
right.
They should go hear this because they'll be blown away.
Yeah, cool.
You got a really beautiful voice. You write really great songs.
Thanks. And they're all available for free download, too, if anyone likes them. Because they change. I take them off and on all the time because I'm writing all the time, so... If people do like them, they need to get them because they might be gone.
Yeah. How many do you have up there at a time? Like, do you have like over 30 or something?
I think there's like 60 now. But I think I'm capped out. So to put one on, I have to take one off.
Is that a free? You have a free thing?
Yeah.
That's still a lot.
Yeah. It's fun.
Is there anything I'm missing? I've really enjoyed talking to you. This has been a really non-structured conversation where we've just kind of talked and it's been great. Yeah.
I wonder.
I feel like now we're friends.
There's Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We need to listen to metal records.
Yeah.
I think I probably talked about metal a lot. I probably covered that. I don't know. I think we did it.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do a part two.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You definitely have to come back and do it again.
In like 35 years, and we'll see what happens.
I thought I would get you on that night, because that's when Bob said that he wanted to do it. That night that I met you at the W, back to the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah, wow. I really sorry.
I think I might have actually asked you. And that's when I found out that you lived in Nashville. You were drunk.
It sounds like it.
I was drunk.
Okay.
Because I think I saw you guys when I was waiting for a cab. Well, and that W is like fucking four blocks away.
Well, that might be why you thought I was so funny, if you had a lot to drink.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I doubt I was actually that funny.
Yeah, I think even Bob was like, you should get this guy to be on. He's funny. And then we started talking.
I don't think I've been very funny today on this podcast, though.
I've enjoyed it.
I've saved my humor.
Yeah, save it. Save it for the next one. The next one will just be nuts.
Oh, it'll be, yeah. It'll be crazy.
All right, Clint Wells, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
What a cool dude, huh? Clint Wells. Zuri and I went that night and saw him play with Bob. They were great. They actually ended up playing like Ozzy and Sabbath and all this weird shit at the end that was really fun. But he's an entertaining guy and a great musician. I think you should go to ClintWellsMusic.com and find out that last song that you just heard, Brooklyn Blues. I think he just posted it like a couple of days ago. Like it's in the songwriting game. He's got tons of songs on that SoundCloud. So go to ClintWellsMusic.com. Click on that SoundCloud thing and go check him out. You can find out who he's playing with, who he's going to be on tour with. He just finished his tour with Bob. I do not know what he's doing next, but next time he comes to town, I would like to get together and have lunch or coffee with him. All right, Clint Wells, ClintWellsMusic.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And you can also like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? And if you want to get even more involved, you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram. I am at Johnny Gowdy, all right? Let's hear some more music from Clint Wells' SoundCloud page. All right, let's get down.
Holding hands in the summer rain, I pull you near, but I turn away. What if I don't feel the same? What if I can never change? I fade in and fade out of love with you. I fade in and fade out of love with you. Some know what you want. Inside my mind, all I wanted you to say is that you wanted me to stay. Feed. if I never feel the same? Would you want me?